Live from Lane County, Oregon, it's the Bo's Nose Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Bolsevich. And now, here's Jay.
Good evening and welcome to the Bo's Nose Show. And don't forget, anytime you want to participate, you can call in at 646-721-9887. And this is the 301st broadcast for KRBN radio here on the internet. And I'm happy to be that 301st broadcast. And I just have to real quick apologize to Fox News and the Ducks for killing their ratings tonight. My guest reminded me that we were competing with them. So my apologies. And, you know, if I'm impacting Donald's event there for the veterans, too, I'm sorry about that. But so tonight we're going to switch gears a little bit. You know, last week it was all things budget. This week it's a kind of a little bit different thing. It's about homelessness and youth in particular. And my guest tonight is Craig Opperman, who is the executive director for Looking Glass Community Services. So welcome to the show, Craig.
Thanks, Jay. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. So who is Craig Opperman? And how do you end up being the executive director for a nonprofit? I mean, what's your background?
Thanks for that question, too. I'll try and run down 30 years of work in a couple minutes or less. But let me first start out by saying what I know about you. Jay, I just appreciate you bringing me on, and that just reflects some of the many things you do. You, as elected leader, have always really kept up on issues that affect the health and safety of our community, and I really thank you for your leadership and work to improve the status of all of our citizens from your elected leadership role. So thanks a lot for your service there.
Thanks, Craig.
Let me, what I'll do is quickly, my mother and father, who I always loved and still love, even though they passed, my father was a school teacher and then a school principal and then an administrator and became deputy superintendent, and my mom was the CEO of our household, and when all the kids left, she became a nurse, and so that sort of shows I really honored and looked up to them, and they handed some stuff to me well. They were always really helping people and working in social service type endeavors and health endeavors. And so I became a counselor and a clinician and a therapist and did a lot of work in therapy, particularly with kids and young people, but also all ages. And I ended up developing a special expertise in trauma treatment. And most of my clinical years, the first, I got my master's degree at Southern Illinois University, and my first half of my career.
Ms. Saluki.
Pardon?
That you're a Saluki.
No, I was a Cougar. We were the across. The Salukis were in Carbondale, and we were in Edwardsville. I was in the other campus that was always competing with them. So, yes, and that's exactly. We had quite a rivalry with them. We wanted to form our own university, but we weren't able to pull it off. But, yeah, they were our sister school, same board of directors. But, yeah, so then I did clinical work for about the first third, half to third of my career, mainly doing trauma treatment. And what happened was I really, in working with particularly sexually abused and physically abused and neglected kids, found that the system didn't work for them at all. The justice system didn't work well. Society didn't understand a lot of the issues. There needed to be bigger policy and social change. So I became more of an advocate and tried to do some program development and did a lot of education of my own in terms of business aspects, and then really moved more into administration and program development, and that led me into more of executive management and director and executive positions, and was able to start a really significant child abuse program up in Multnomah County and some other things, some community-based residential treatment programs that really well dealt with intensive kids' needs, but got very much engaged with politics and advocacy and program development. And so that kind of led to leading agencies and having that ability to really affect some major change, which eventually led me from Portland and Multnomah and Washington and Clackamas County work down to Eugene to be able to take the leadership position at Looking Glass. At the time, I was Looking Glass Youth and Family Services when I came in 2004, and now we are Looking Glass Community Services. So, and we serve between 8,000 and 10,000 clients a year, and we can talk more about the details of where those numbers come from, but that's kind of about me. I'm honoring my parents and trying to help in ways I can. I'm still learning and still trying, but I'm really lucky to be able to lead an organization like Looking Glass in this community.
Well, speaking of Looking Glass, so let's talk a little bit about Looking Glass. They've been around for a while. They were here before you got here. I remember when you came to town, because I think the first time I met you was at a Rubicon Society meeting at lunchtime, right about that time. And I think I might have actually been the president of Rubicon at the time. So
I think it's been I believe it was an election year. And
Yeah.
That's right. 2004, that would have been.
Yeah, there was this Bush-Cheney thing going on about then. So what is Looking Glass? They've been in around the community for a while, but what's the history, and then what are the services they currently provide?
The one sentence answer is that we are a large behavioral health organization. What that means is that we do a lot of mental health therapy and counseling. We do a lot of alcohol and drug treatment counseling and therapy. We do crisis intervention. And we also do a lot of education programs along with that. So we have a couple schools that specialize in kids that have not been able to make it in the regular schools. And most, if not all of them, are just as smart and talented as any kids you would meet, but they've not been able to meet sort of the regular expectations of the regular classroom or school setting, or they've had some specific types of learning disabilities or challenges. And so we have education programs that really specifically meet them where they are and grow their education that way. So education is a really big, important part of what we do. But we serve children and young people, youth, young adults, and adults. But our real special area of service and our expertise that's nationally recognized is on that 12 to 22-year-old age group, that most of them are teenagers, and they really have their own unique set of challenges. They're not yet an adult, and they're not still kids. And as most of anybody knows, that's a tough time. Even if you've got the best family and the best life situation, it's hard to grow through adolescence. And so we really like those young people and really develop our expertise and a lot of our energy around serving them to make it so they can become good, productive adults and be healthy and happy.
So obviously Looking Glass was in existence before you got here. How long has it been around?
It started in 1970. A young woman who, Deborah Warnes is her name, she was, I believe, a runaway herself. She definitely had some experience with the street and knew of kids on the street and decided she wanted to help them. So through volunteer work, she got some other U of O students together. I believe she was at U of O. And a group of volunteers started Looking Glass to help runaway kids on the street, young people that were runaway and homeless. And that morphed into some real official program development. I think we actually got certified as a 501c3 around 74, although the organization existed since 1970. And then we've morphed since then. Both my predecessor and I really have developed program continuums primarily focused on that 12 to 22-year-old age range, but programs in general that meet the needs of the community. So we have outpatient services where you could go and get an hour of therapy a week or go to a therapy group once a month if you needed to. And we also have day treatment programs, which involves a lot of our schools, as I mentioned before, but where young people could go all day to schools and classrooms and get some therapeutic help there too. And then we have residential services, which literally those young people need 24/7 help and supervision. So they've hit such a rough spot in their behavioral responses that they need to be in residential. And so we have about 60 kids. I'm going to get the numbers wrong. I'd have to look. But quite a few young people who are living in programs with us. And that's a real intensive service. And those are all mental health and alcohol and drug treatment programs for those people. And then we have an intensive psychiatric residential program that serves kids who, if they weren't there, they'd be in a psychiatric hospital for some stabilization. So they're kind of one step down from some really intensive psychiatric needs. And then the other part of our program continuum is Runaway Homeless Youth Services, and we offer an entire comprehensive system of care for runaway and homeless youth. So we have a shelter where they can come to be safely housed and get food and clothing. They can also go to school there, and the main goal there is to get them back on track to their families, or to back into the community and off the streets into a safe community and home place. And then we have an outreach center there that does provide, you know, meals during the day and sometimes in the evening, and clothes and lockers and access to the internet. We try and help them get jobs, and so most of the older kids often are accessing the outreach center, which is kind of what we call, or what people would know it by, where you can kind of walk up and get help. And there's some medical help there. There's some alcohol and drug and mental health counseling there. So we really try and wrap services all around that. One thing I'll mention quickly, Jay, because I know we're going to move through a lot of different subject areas, but the intensive residential services, the psychiatric residential, that didn't exist here in Lane County before I got here, and it's a system that I was very familiar with from working in up north. And we established that here with the support of the board and the community. It's been a broad-based effort, and what it does is, before those kids, if you were a family in Lane County and your teenager needed intense residential psychiatric services, they'd have to go to Portland or to Grants Pass would be the closest place that that could happen for them. Now they can stay right here at home. And as everybody knows, the closer to home the services are, the more likely you're to have an effective transition back out. So that was really a success for the community and took a lot of work on our part. It's real challenging work, but we really are glad that we're able to offer that to the community now. It was never here before.
That's great. And you guys also offer one of the few alcohol and drug treatment programs for girls in this area.
That's right. We have, of those residential programs, one of them is a 15-bed program for girls. So it's a gender-specific girls treatment service. And it offers them mental health counseling and alcohol and drug treatment that's often referred as co-occurring disorders. But, yes, that it's the only residential service for teenage girls with alcohol and drug and mental health issues.
Yeah, and before that was there, that there was nothing in the area for that either. So
that's right.
You guys offer some really critical services, and it's, you know, I've had the opportunity kind of to interact at least with Station 7 one time on a personal basis when I had a next-door neighbor's 15-year-old runaway and need services, and ended up dealing with Station 7, which is your runaway program, and they were able to work with his family and him and negotiate a return to home for him at the time, which was, you know, a pretty significant thing. That was the interesting part, was how your staff there works with the runaways' families and kind of works to, you know, put them back together to find out what the real issues are and resolve those issues and come to some agreements and even work with the families in a longer term basis to try and resolve the issues that caused the runaway in the first place. So
I really appreciate that story, Jay. That's exactly right. That gives perfect insight into what we try to do there. We're really focused on, and well over half of the young people that come to Station 7 end up going home or to an extended family member. So they might not be able to get right back home, but they'll go to grandma or aunt and uncle or big brother. And so oftentimes we're getting them back into their family. And as you sort of implied, but also everybody knows that, that's really a huge success, because we're saving those kids from being on the street and being victimized, but also getting them back into regular mainstream schools and jobs and just kind of saving their life, really.
Yeah. And then I did get the opportunity to speak to one of your graduating ceremonies for, I think, was it your Crossroads program, I believe?
It was Riverfront School.
Riverfront School, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah. And at Riverfront School, that was, and listening to valedictorian, if you would put it that way. I wasn't quite sure that's what they called him, but the representative from the graduating class speak. The amount of hard times in his life that he was able to overcome, and how eloquently he spoke and seemed well prepared for the world, and all, was just, it was amazing that, you know, he had obviously been through a huge transition through that program. It was just great to meet those kids. And that's, you know, just a whole different service you guys provide in that alternative school setting, where some of these kids that truly are the square peg trying to get in the round hole, you've got a bunch of square holes for them. So.
That's right. You know, it is really true. I so appreciate that, Jay. It's great you have such a working knowledge and experience with some of our services, because you're absolutely right. Those kids, that group of kids that you spoke to that night, that group of probably 15 or 20 graduates, their graduation rate before they came to our school would have been zero. They had all either dropped out or been expelled or not able to attend regular school, and so they would have been on it. We already have a not a really good graduation rate in Oregon, as most people know, for high school. And that group that you spoke to of graduates, they went from zero to, you know, that school graduates about 65 to 70% of its kids, which is close to what the regular rate is. The difference is, mm-hmm. those are kids that all, we took them from zero to a 70% graduation rate. And their stories, as you said, they are incredible. I mean, I had a loving home and support for doing homework and good food and transportation, and it still is tough to make it through school sometimes. These kids, a lot of times, did not have support, did not even have a home at points of their high school life. And to hear them talk about their successes, and as you said, the way they have turned out is just astonishing. And one of the things I think about, you reminded me of, Jay, is the resilience of these kids. And I learn a lot from our staff. I learn a lot from our board. I learn a lot from the community. But I learn more from the young people we serve than anywhere or from anybody else. And what they go through and how resilient they are, it seems almost miraculous to hear some of the things that they've survived and how well they've thrived out of that. And we are really honored to be just a little big push of their success there, because it is amazing, their resilience.
Yeah, it is. And it was really kind of an honor on my part to be able to be part of that ceremony, getting those kids, you know, on to the next part of their life, which is, you know, that's kind of another interesting aspect of Looking Glass, is you guys also provide some kind of like transitional services for the 17 and 18 year olds that are going to suddenly become emancipated adults and have to survive that early adulthood, without the support of that the system generally provides most kids, you know, through the foster system or other means, suddenly they kind of get cut loose, and you guys have got a pretty good way of transitioning and teaching some life skills and all, getting those folks ready to be emancipated adults, which is, you know, that's kind of why you guys go from 12 to 22.
That's
you don't
right.
just drop them at the curb at 18.
No, you're exactly right. Again, we have independent living programs and we have transitional living programs. And as everybody knows, once you get out of high school, in some ways, that's just the beginning. So to help them get through high school and then make sure that they're just not left without any support or help after that is really key. So the kids that don't have a family support or resources to really wrap around them, we provide a lot of that service to them. We can continue their mental health or alcohol and drug treatment supports, but also provide life skills, teach them how to manage a budget, help them get set up in their own apartments, help them have savings accounts, and learn how to navigate the system out there in terms of finding jobs and how to do resumes and present themselves. And then several of our programs have work experiences. We have a pretty major work crew that we offer through Riverfront School, in partnership with Lane Workforce Partnership. And we get some federal dollars and some local dollars, and we actually have training crews for the kids that go out and work on the trails and clean up the rivers and have a great learning experience there and build their resume. And then we have culinary arts program where they literally are in cooking contests and learning how to learn some pre-chef type abilities. And we have a nursing preparation program to health occupations that prepares them for the medical field, which, as we know, is all growing and going to continue to grow. And so those are some of the specific things we really try and build with them and then help them with afterwards so they can continue to develop a career.
Well, that sounds like you guys are just doing a great job of turning some very at-risk youth into successful adults ultimately, which is, I think, the kind of puts in a nutshell what Looking Glass is, helping at-risk youth and their families so that they ultimately become successful adults. But getting back to at-risk youth a little bit, I kind of teased this a little on Facebook that we were going to talk about 15th Night, but I didn't really talk about what that was. So
right.
And how that's important, and then a possible solution to the homeless problem in the long run. So what is the 15th Night? You know, why is there this thing called the 15th Night?
Well, our Runaway and Homeless Youth Services are engaged in a national network, the National Network for Youth, and with the National Family Youth Services Bureau. And sometimes we're successful in getting grants from them, but whether we get grants or not, we're part of that national organization. And so we attend a lot of trainings. We do a lot of continuing education with them. We find out not only what's needed to help runaway and homeless youth in Oregon, but throughout the United States. And some of the research that we're tapped into, that we participate in, we submit data, and we're part of the national research base. But one of the things that our staff learned at a couple workshops several years ago was kind of a no-brainer, but it labeled the fact that if a young person is on the streets for more than a couple weeks, that they have a far less likelihood of, and that, you know, the numbers are always kind of moving around, but basically it looked like about an 80% chance that they would end up being chronically homeless or have some significant times of homelessness as an adult. And so it's sort of the inverse. If they're not out there for that 15th night, which is where that name comes from, if we get them in off the streets and get them back into a more regular sort of social type setting in terms of living space and school and activities, that they're about 80% less likely to end up in a pattern of chronic homelessness. So that's kind of where the concept comes from. There's been, you know, several different groups and several different folks locally as well as at different parts of the United States that have identified that as a real goal or part of their strategic plan to try and have those youth really target those underage youth and not let them get to that 15th night out on the street. We've been one of the leaders and drivers, coordinated really closely with the city manager here to develop some inertia around that locally. And so it's something that there's a lot of people that are becoming aware of and really concerned about how to do that. So part of what happened with us, too, Jay, is that we had a really comprehensive continuum of care. And when the economy crashed and a lot of the federal dollars became more difficult to get, we literally cut nearly 40% of our runaway and homeless youth services. And at the same time, because of that same economic crash, the numbers of kids and families that were pushed from the barely surviving, not being on the streets, over the edge into having severe economic issues that caused them to lose their apartment or their home or their jobs, caused the numbers of needs to go up. So we have just been pained since 2010 until about a year ago at the fact that we had such decimated resources. Now, some people might have seen that some of the spots we've done, we got a significant federal grant restored, and so we've been on TV and in the papers about that. It's not nearly enough to serve the need, but we have really restored a lot of our continuum that we lost. We have gotten all three of our federal grants back funded now, and we've gotten some grants from the state. We've been, Looking Glass and I have been really active with the state to tell the state that, hey, the state has some responsibility for these young people, especially since many of them are kids that were unsuccessful in foster care. A lot of the runaway and homeless youth had been in the foster care system and hadn't transitioned out successfully. So the state agreed that, you know, those still are our kids, even though they're difficult to find and difficult to deal with, that we have some responsibility there. So we've actually added some new revenue streams from state grants. And one of those, in fact, that started in October specifically addresses trafficking. So not even just sex trafficking, but also labor trafficking of kids. And so we've really been able, like I've said before, we don't have enough, but we really have the ability now to do some comprehensive service approaches to the kids on the streets like we weren't able to do, you know, even 2 years ago. So we were doing it before, but much more limited. Like, for example, our outreach grant that got restored, when we had lost that, we were down to about two or three afternoons of doing outreach in the Eugene area. Now we're back up to six afternoons. So almost every day of the week, we've got a team out there that's walking the streets. They're down at Kesey Plaza. They're down at the Transit Mall. They're at Monroe Park. They're down at the river. They're looking around to see what kids are out there that we can possibly engage and help. And those teams are just expert at forming relationships with those young people. So they always start out by giving them their basic needs. During the summer, we give out a lot of water. All year round, we give out a lot of socks and some, you know, other pieces of clothing or jackets, depending on the weather, some medical aid, some food or snack bars. And then after developing some relationships, a lot of times they're likely to come to our New Roads Outreach Center. And if they're underage, we really are trying to make sure to get them through Station 7 services and figure out a way to patch them back into their homes and home community and get them off the street.
Yeah. So I just want to jump back to the 15th night for a minute and just reiterate for folks the concept is basically if a youth is homeless or on the streets for more than 2 weeks, they're, you know, approximately, and like you said, the numbers move around, but more like than 80% likely to be chronically homeless or have periods of extended homelessness as an adult. Now, there's been quite a bit of talk in the Lane County community and nationally even about how do we fix homelessness. I mean, I was in San Diego a couple weeks back, and I was just surprised of the homeless population on the streets in downtown San Diego and on their waterfront in really nice areas, Gaslight District of San Diego, and go around the corner and there's, you know, homeless tents and everything set up. It was surprising to me. So it's not just Lane County that this is a big issue. But it seems to me that, you know, all this discussion of doing housing first or, you know, how do we deal with the homeless population, it sure be easier in the long run if we could deal with keeping youth from not being homeless for that 15th night. So we keep, you know, if we can intercept them in that first 14 days and get them off the street, and so they don't become homeless adults, then it is sometimes for us to try and correct the homelessness issues of somebody that's already chronically homeless, because then you're usually dealing with multiple issues, addiction issues, mental health, criminal records, because they've been in and out of, you know, the criminalization of homelessness that goes on. So it's kind of, I just want to stress for people again, it's all about getting to youth in the first 2 weeks and getting them off the street. And that will ultimately kind of turn off the tap of homelessness. It won't cure all homelessness. I mean, some people develop problems as an adult that create the reason they become homeless. It doesn't always happen from youth, but a good portion of the homeless population's behavior started in their teenage ages. Almost every person you talk to that has an addiction issue more started some of their addictive behaviors as a teenager. Very few waited till complete adulthood. Probably the exception to that rule might be our veterans, but there's been a significant effort to house veterans in Lane County. This is about maybe a long-term solution. If we can get these kids off the streets in the first 2 weeks, we could be dealing a blow to homelessness for years to come. So,
no, you really hit it there, Jay. So you're really talking about prevention, which, you know, and going upstream to stop the pipeline. And I really agree with you. I will say that treatment at any age is preventative. So, you know, even if you're 70 or 80 years old and you get treatment for an issue for mental health or alcohol and drugs, that's preventative. But really, to get to the crux, which is just what you pointed out, to really stop the large numbers of homelessness, one of the effective things would be to really get enough resources around the young people, the teenagers and the young adults that are right on that cusp of, do they fall into it or can they be pulled back out of it? And as you said, that doesn't mean it's going to be completely gone, but it absolutely will reduce the numbers. We don't do a good enough job of resourcing those underage youth especially. So we have the only licensed and accredited shelter for runaway and homeless youth in Lane County, and we've gone through periods of not having enough staff to be able to staff it up to use it all, and we've gone through periods when we're staffed up and there's kids that we have to turn away because the needs are so great. And so we're continually building on that, and we're having some success, but we really do need to get services to those underage youth. And I think one thing is, I have an empathy and compassion for all ages of homelessness, but I think that there tends to be some different feelings toward, you know, how old they are or not. Should they get a job? You know, I would argue you can't expect a 15-year-old to go get a job and live on their own.
That's on a lease.
Right. It's clear that, for those people, we really need to give some special attention. We don't even need to have that argument about whether they brought it on themselves. They haven't. They really need our help and support and as many resources as we can wrap around them to make sure that they're not that 25-year-old or 30-year-old later that we're arguing about whether they should be out there or not. To prevent that pipeline from being so big and interrupting the causes of much of the homelessness will help. There's always going to be economic issues and other issues, but to at least divert as many of those young people away and back into a healthy, good system will reduce the numbers later on. We won't necessarily see it right away, but we will see it. And the other thing that you mentioned too, Jay, is in terms of human sex trafficking, by far the largest, most vulnerable population to being coerced or literally kidnapped or forced into that life are the runaway and homeless youth. Most of them are girls. There are some boys, but every once in a while there are kids, you know, literally from anybody's family that went to the mall and made a bad choice or got manipulated. But those are the rare cases. The common cases are these kids. You know, we have girls that come up to our outreach center or to our shelter, and if they don't show up the next night, except for us, nobody knows. Nobody's looking for them. Nobody's out, you know, calling the police or wandering around wondering why they didn't come home because they didn't have a home. And believe me, the gangs know that. And much of the trafficking has moved into gangs. Rather than the old traditional thought of a pimp, trafficking, they're still there, but more and more it's moved into the hands of gangs. And gangs use these poor victim young people as a revenue source. They use them up and throw them away. And the other piece that, you know, in kind of back in the day, you'd see areas of town where there would be young people portrayed on the street to be sold for sex. And that was not easy, but easier for the police to know and for the community to know kind of where that's happening and how maybe they could intervene. Most of that moved to the Internet and moved to online, and so that's harder to track. But now it's even, you know, the police have done a good job of doing stings and interrupting a lot of the Internet traffic, although there's much more than they can interrupt. But now it's even moved to where it's kind of word of mouth. It's communities, it's parties, it's these gang members that are infiltrating social networks and letting people know, or even groups of business people know, that they have, you know, people available for sale. And so it's really difficult once you've lost somebody to there to get them back out. It's an underground economy that's really being driven by some really hard criminal gang type people. So we really are trying to keep kids from ever getting there, and that's back to your original point, to prevent them from getting there is the main thing. And so if they're not around, if they're not on the streets, that takes away that pipeline for those gang members. But also we do get kids coming up to our services who we either know directly or kind of indirectly from them or their peers that they're being trafficked. And so that's why we now have this new staff position, and our case managers and our outreach workers are already well-schooled in how to identify and help connect with those folks. But one of the challenges is when those young people have an opportunity to get into services to help them, or if they're even arrested and the system knows that that's what happened, they're picked up and it becomes apparent that they're being trafficked, it's really difficult to have a situation where they want to move to the light, so to speak, where they want to get out of that lifestyle because they've been so brainwashed and so manipulated and oftentimes addicted to drugs or alcohol, and then told that the system is going to treat them as criminals or the system won't love them or treat them as well as these gang manipulators do. And so it's a really hard line to walk. You don't want to lock them up to make them stick around to testify. And if you don't lock them up, they have a tendency to run away or get back to those gang people or be afraid and go back. You know, a lot of times the gang folks will say, hey, we're going to kill your pets and your younger brother and sister if you don't come back to us. And so they're really in a thankless position, and the system has a hard time figuring out to respond to them. So one of the things, I will say Senator Wyden, I really give him a lot of credit, and Senator Merkley too, they have really looked at, is there a way to address this issue more effectively, both nationally and locally? And Senator Wyden's staff here is really concerned about it. And we've talked about some different possibilities, such as having a safe location for those young girls primarily that would be a regular home but would be out of the, would not be known and would be away from an urban center where the gangs might be. And that way they'd have a chance to sort of undo some of the brainwashing. They wouldn't have to be locked up in a jail setting until they testify or refuse to testify. And it would be a little more empathic approach to them, a little more therapeutic approach to them as victims that we're hoping to get out of there, as opposed to them feeling like they're being criminalized or have their freedoms taken away. But it is a really complex issue, and I will tell you it's one of the main focuses of our agency. Our board and our staff and the Runaway Homeless Youth Services realize that this is something we need to really address. The magnitude of it is really hard to determine. That's one where the statistics are really difficult to pin down. And it could be that one weekend there seems to be several young people that are trafficked in Eugene, and then you may go for a couple weeks or months without even knowing or being aware of another one. I know that there's more kids being trafficked that we're not aware of than that we become aware of. But the magnitude's hard to put a finger on. However, those kids are really being horribly abused. So even if there's one or two a year, we owe it to ourselves to interrupt that process and build some resources that can effectively wrest those kids away from that system.
Yeah, and quite often those kids that are being trafficked are they actually get recruited or picked up in one city and moved to another city to kind of remove them from any support system. And they talk about the I-5 corridor and how that relates to human trafficking and how a town like Eugene is just a great recruiting spot for those gangs, you know, where there's disaffected youth that, you know, are going to hang out with the travelers, so to speak, and down at the mall. And that makes a great hunting ground for those predators that are part of those gangs, and then they take them up to Portland or they whisk them down to California somewhere, or even as far up as Seattle, because a lot of these gangs, when I'm talking to the City of Eugene Police Department, their gang expert, these gangs are tied with larger gangs in other cities. You know, Eugene's not, it has a couple, maybe one or two local gangs, but almost all the gangs operating in Eugene. And if people don't believe their gang's operating, one day they need an education from this City of Eugene guy about how to read graffiti. Once you understand how to read graffiti, you realize there's lots of gangs in Eugene. And that's a really sad thing that these kids are being victimized. But if we could manage to get them off the street quickly, we might actually reduce the predator population, because then there's no one there to recruit, so they'll go somewhere else, or you know, which you kind of hate to see them go somewhere else, but at least we'd be protecting our local youth.
It's even twofold, Jay. It's exactly what you said in terms of if we take away who they can recruit here, by really effectively getting out there and intervening and getting those young people off the streets before they can get them off the street into their clutches, that's a big victory, and it really does save our local kids and community, as well as make us look less attractive for recruiting. But as you mentioned, the other thing is we are part of the issue for us is we are on that I-5 corridor, and so sometimes, too, there'll be kids that they get from Vancouver, B.C., or Seattle that they'll bring to town to try and make money off of. And again, if there's a situation where they have come to our outreach center for some help, our kids or our outreach, our peers, their peer kids that talk to us, our staff see them at the transit mall, that if we can interrupt them as they're coming through, even though they're from another community, that's a real help too. And it sort of is what your point is. The word would get out, you know, don't go to Eugene. Don't even try to have this type of criminal activity there. And then, you know, hopefully all the rest of the communities can do that. But all we can do right now is double down on ours. And if we can eliminate it here, that's a success for all the kids up and down that I-5 corridor.
Yeah, so that kind of brings me to kind of what's the magnitude of the problem, what's the lift here. So yesterday was our annual point-in-time count of the homeless population in Lane County, which is an always interesting thing, and people are like, well, how do you count homeless people? With great difficulty. It's a large effort. But, you know, the estimations, I think the actual count, you know, comes out to about 1,500, but the estimates are there's at least about 3,000 possibly homeless people at any one time in Lane County. But how many of those homeless in any given night are these youth that we could get before the 15th night?
Our data, and I will mention, I think the Human Services Commission here has some really dedicated, hardworking staff on that issue, and they're doing the count. Our staff, a lot of our staff volunteer to help with that count, too, and you're right, it's an inexact science. But what our data from encounters with the kids and the work we do with them and being aware of who's on the street as well as who actually gets into our services, we're really looking at between 50 and 150 underage youth a year that are new faces to us. So a lot of times, you know, we'll see a kid in February and they'll be in our services. They'll come to the outreach center or come to the shelter. We'll provide dozens of services to them over a couple months period. So that doesn't count as a dozen kids. That's that one kid. So what we noticed is that there's anywhere from 50 to 150. So we're figuring that's really right around 100 each year. There's some new young people on the streets that our outreach teams find or that come to Station 7. And by that number, I'm talking about kids that are under the age of 18. So they're 17 years or less of age. And one of the things that's important about that, I appreciate you bringing the magnitude up, because just what you said, when we talk about the homelessness issue, I think we need to really resource it and figure out a way to address all those people's needs or get them where they should be. But that the number seems so great, it's almost like, you know, how do we deal with thousands of people and not enough resources? This is a good number for two reasons. One, it's very manageable. You know, to think of how could we help 100 kids or 100 people is much easier than how could we help 4,000. And the other thing is, it's kids. It's younger people. I mean, there's just almost nobody who has an opinion about homelessness that doesn't want to help young people get off the street. We know that they don't deserve to be there, they shouldn't be there, and that we can keep them and get them into better situations with a much greater success rate. So for us to really focus on that, you know, 100-ish or so kids that are newly homeless each year and make sure that they're never out there for any length of time that's over 2 weeks, that would really help the community in terms of doing some prevention and having a big impact on what this issue is overall down the road.
Yeah, and it'd be, you know, it does so many things in so many ways. One, it's kind of turning off the inflow of homelessness to a degree. Two, it's removing these kids from the streets and reducing their population for the predators that are trying to move them into human trafficking. And you know, three, it's a doable number. You know, and we already have some services that are set up to do this. We just don't, we haven't quite funded them in a way that we can guarantee that we're going to get to every one of those 100 kids before the 15th night. So kind of how far are we from that? You know, you talk about having your teams that do get out to the transit station and down in the mall and stuff like that. What do you think it might take for us locally in Lane County to get to the point where no underage kid would be homeless for more than 14 days?
You know, it's an educated guess is the best I can do for you, but it would be pretty educated. We need to scale up. So I'm tempted to say that we need a lot more shelter capacity, and on the surface it would look like that. But in reality, if we have enough services connected to those initial encounters with these young people, we can probably have less need for shelter, at least for any length of time. Because if we've got, you know, we've just restored our alcohol and drug and mental health therapist to the service array, and they can do some family counseling. We've got case managers that can work with the kids as they come in and when they go out, and that could actually visit with a family, have contact with the family. The more of those types of services that are engaged in their community and in their home, in their extended families, in their schools, that community connection will help keep them from needing a lot of deeper end services. But that takes a lot of work, and there's a lot of difficult issues that need to be faced and dealt with. And so that it would require, you know, some resources. I would say just on the surface, you know, that to at least double or more what we're currently doing would really make a dent, would really get closer to that number. The other part I will say in terms of resources, there's a lot of folks that want to help and do help, and a lot of community goodwill. One of the things I will say, and sometimes with some of the kids, it's difficult, but we're really committed to safety and quality programs. And so, like, if a young person comes up to our shelter and they're obviously drunk or stoned or incapacitated in some way that could be dangerous to them or others, we're either calling 911 if we need to, or we're sitting with them in a neutral area before we allow them into the living environment for the protection of the other kids that are there. And we're licensed by the state. We're nationally accredited. And a lot of what they're focused on, which I really appreciate, is really safe and quality services. So we're constantly being reviewed. We have licensing people come through. We have people from the federal government, from the Federal Youth Services Bureau, that come and review our programs and look at what we're doing and make sure that the facilities and services are safe. And as you can imagine, I mean, we need to have our kitchen all up to health code standards. We're really focused on that, and the reason I mention all that, number one, is to let everybody know that's what we do. We're really focused on safety and quality, but also that's expensive. You know, that's a lot different than a couple people just saying, well, let's have six kids stay at our house tonight. And so to have the resources to make sure that there's a real qualitative involvement and some real professional involvement to help get them back to home and community, it can cost some money.
Yeah. So just to go back, you kind of casually mentioned it'd be about twice what you're currently doing to get to these 100 kids, you know, to guarantee these 100 kids wouldn't hit the 15th night. What's your annual budget for Looking Glass? You
well,
don't mind me asking.
That's fine. For our overall agency, we run between 10 and 12 million. And the reason that, you know, it sounds like a – it's not because any money's missing, believe me. We know where every nickel is, but we account for every paperclip we buy. But we'll get a grant, we'll lose a grant, we'll get a contract, we lose a contract. One of the things that you've been helpful to us with just recently is the Lane County Shelter that we're going to operate in partnership with the Department of Human Services in Lane County here. And so that's a new contract that comes on board this year. So we have contracts that end and begin. So that's our overall agency budget fluctuates back and forth there. our runaway homeless youth services run about $1.5 million or less, and that's for the whole comprehensive service. We have a rural program in Cottage Grove to deal with the kids there in the rural community, and we have our outreach program. We have a transitional living program that includes some apartments that are above our outreach center, and then a lot of outreach, and then we do shelter services. And so those programs all put together are usually a little less than $1 million, between $1 million and $1.5 million, and that really fluctuates with the federal grants. That's what, you know, when we hit that rough spot, those were down to, you know, about $700,000 or less. We were really close to half of what we needed or were used to doing. And so we would kind of need to double that service from where it exists now.
So $1.5 million.
That roughly
sounds like the amount we get if the state managed the state forest the way they did before they changed their policy. And the Lynn, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Lynn County's lawsuit with the state over managing the state forest, but the amount of revenue Lane County is losing right now is about $1.4 to $1.5 million a year. Because of the change in management style. So just think about that a little bit, folks out there, that, you know, if we could be pulling these kids off the street, you know, if possible. But so, yeah, that's not a very big lift for a community this size. You know, we're 350,000 plus people here in Lane County, starting to approach 360. To come up with $1.5 million a year additional monies to try and prevent these kids from becoming chronically homeless, victims of human trafficking, just seems almost like a no-brainer, and so much easier than trying to deal with 3,000 to 4,000 homeless adults. I can't tell you how much I support the idea of the 15th Night Initiative and how much I think it makes sense as a conservative, because we're trying to do things on the front end to prevent a lot of damage on the back end. It's like we could spend this $1.5 million here, or we can spend tens of millions later in jail beds and prison beds and trying to get adults that are addicted, to get them off of whatever they're addicted to and all that. So,
yeah, I really appreciate you making that connection, Jay, and the way you frame that. I think it's totally a huge. It would be hugely supported by both the R's and the D's and the independents, and you know, most any community member that learned a little bit about it would be in support of that. And the way you connected to the dots on that $1.5 million is, I really appreciate that. I like the way you're thinking about that.
Yeah,
and it actually isn't much money when you think of it. It's a lot of money to Looking Glass. It's not much money when you look at county or state budgets or community costs down the line. We really, again, this is local and federal data you cobble together, but really, a dollar spent on these services really saves more than $4 down the road, just for what you said.
Yeah.
You know, adult mental health and alcohol and drug issues, putting them in jail instead of having them work. And you have to look at going to the emergency department for medical care. And so it's really a two-way street. Not only are they using services, but they're not being taxpayers and having a productive, happy career or living that they're paying taxes in. So it catches you on both sides.
Yeah, and we didn't even touch on the fact that alcohol and drug addiction treatment for youth tends to have a much more effective rate of success than it does for adults.
That's right.
Which is a whole other issue. If we can intercept these when they're kids and deal with their problems, if we have a higher rate of success. Because everybody, I also have a lot of knowledge of Willamette Family Services, which deals with the adult side of this.
Excellent.
I had one particular friend that is in recovery now, but I remember her going into Willamette Family on 3 separate occasions and being unsuccessful every one of those times. And it eventually took another intervention through Serenity Lane, actually, for her to be successful. And in that case, it was that she got connected with whatever the new drug is that deals with opioids. And helping with that opioid addiction. But it is, you know, there's so much more effectiveness if we can get them as kids and get them back. And I don't know anyone that can argue that it's the kids' fault, you know?
That's right. No, that's really true.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, they just need to get a job. We do have a very active coordinated care organization here that's very much aware of and tuned into the fact that we need to improve our adolescent health in the community. And this addresses all of those things, too. And again, if you look at the amount of money we spend in the healthcare system, that $1.5 million starts to look like not that much because we have a lot, it's not wasted, a lot of money that could be better spent in healthcare if we could effectively get people from letting their health deteriorate because they're not taking care of themselves, because they're on the streets, or they're letting infections get worse, or they're going to the emergency department instead of their doctor if they have a doctor. And so to do that, you know, that this addressing those young people really saves healthcare costs too. They're the ones that are also developing chronic physical health problems as adults by being out there.
Yeah. So we're down to about 3 or 4 minutes left here, Craig. One quick question. Should a kid be afraid of approaching Looking Glass or coming to, Station 7 or anything like that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, they really shouldn't. When the Occupy movement was underneath the bridges down at Washington Jefferson, 7th Street, 6th Street there, our team would go through there. I went through there. We were really on the lookout for underage kids that were in there. And one of the things, and talked to a lot of folks who were really trying to help those people there, and we had some lively discussions about, you know, the kids want to come to Station 7, but they want to bring their beer and they want to smoke pot that night and watch TV. And we said, no, that's not what happens. I guess one of the things I should emphasize is that we really do expect responsible and accountable behavior. We understand, we tend to be really non-judgmental. We know that there's people making bad decisions, oftentimes with good reasons for those bad decisions, but that's not okay. We would argue that a bad decision or a bad health choice hurts them, even if there's a good reason to make it. So we're trying to get people to really be responsible and accountable, young folks, and help them to that path. And so they could come there, and they could be drunk, or they could be belligerent. We wouldn't let them into our services, but we wouldn't just give up on them either. Our outreach teams, I've seen our outreach teams talk to people who've just been abusive or scary to them. And, you know, it can go to a 911 call. That rarely happens. But they know kind of how to take care of themselves but continue to engage these people. And a lot of kids, I've seen myself with our outreach team, there'll be some kids that you would think would never trust or want to talk to them. And in a couple visits or a couple weeks of them seeing each other and then knowing that person is not afraid of them or really, you know, wants them to get better in their behavior, a lot of times they end up engaging and getting off that path. And I saw that myself when I was a clinician. There were some young people who'd been really traumatized that when we'd first engage in a therapeutic process, they wouldn't like me at all. And a lot of times they were hard to like in terms of their behaviors. But some of them right now, I still have some kids I worked with that call me around the holidays, you know, that I worked with years ago that when we first met, they didn't like me. And so I think that we actually owe it to them to really to present a caring but professional and accountable expectation to them to help get them on the right path. So they'll come there and find out the rules, and sometimes they'll say no way. And a lot of times those same kids that will walk away and say, no, I don't want those rules, they'll be back a couple days later because really they do want things to get better.
Well, Craig, I want to thank you for being on the show, but real quick, why don't you give Looking Glass's contact information if folks want to maybe contribute towards that $1.5 million and prevent the 15th night?
I appreciate that, Jay, and I can guarantee we really spend the money the right way. If you donate to us, it really gets some positive impact. So the
telephone.
Should I go?
Yep. Go.
You can just Google us or go on the web. Lookingglass.us is our web address, and we have a good website, and that tells you everything you need to know.
Good, good. Looking Glass US, and that's it for the Bo's Nose Show tonight. Thank you very much, Craig Opperman.
Thank you, Jake.